On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Con la cafetiera.
Mocha. Express.
Un espresso meglio che al bar.
Caffettiera Mocha Express in 5 misure.
Caffettiera Mocha Express.
Toc, toc, toc. Buonasera. Sono l'omino coi baffi, quello della caffettiera Mocha Express.
Prodotto Vialetti.
The man behind that 1950s advertising campaign for the Mocha Express coffee maker has died. Renato Bialetti was 93. His ashes were buried in one of his signature aluminum pots at his funeral a few weeks ago. For a brief history lesson on how the Mocha Express came to be a kitchen staple, we turn to Jeffrey Schnapp. He is director of a knowledge design lab and production studio at Harvard called MetaLab. Schnapp also wrote a fascinating academic paper titled The Romance of Caffeine and Aluminum. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello, Evan.
So espresso is so wedded in our minds with Italian coffee culture, but it's not actually an Italian invention, nor is espresso an Italian word. So where did the word come from to describe a steam-brewed cup of coffee?
So the history of espresso is very deeply rooted in the history of the spread of coffee consumption throughout Europe and throughout the world, really, in the course of the 19th century, as coffee houses became central features of social life. And there were many ways to prepare coffee that are part of that history, and espresso type coffee emerges, especially towards the second half of the 19th century, not entirely by coincidence during the age of steam engines. Espresso machines, as we think of them today, were largely a product of the second half of the 19th century, and they used a particular method that involved pushing steam at very high temperature and high pressure through coffee grounds to produce that intense brew that we associate with espresso coffee. The word espresso actually came from the French word express, the word for express trains in particular. And the idea of espresso coffee being associated with mobile lifestyles as they were understood circa 1900 was a very strong connection in the mind of coffee drinkers at the time we're speaking about.
Do you have any idea how long it took an espresso machine to show up in a train station bringing these two ideas together?
The connection was a very tight and almost causal one. Coffee houses were, of course, existed in many different kinds of contexts, but train stations played such an important role in the social life of Europe in the second half of the 19th century that the need for social spaces where you could consume on the fly, so to speak, beverages like coffee was perceived very early on. And so really as far back as certainly the 1880s, we begin to see coffee houses as a central feature and espresso machines with their large chromed surfaces, with their boilers, with their large levers, looked as if they spoke the same language of locomotives, trains, express trains, and so forth.
You say that the coming together of caffeine and aluminum was inevitable. Why?
Aluminum was a kind of magic material, a new material in the imagination of people at the turn of the 20th century. It was initially very expensive. It was a precious metal, really, equivalent, say, to platinum today. And it's only in the course of the first 30 to 50 years of the 20th century that aluminum moves from this category of belonging to the precious metals to becoming an industrial material that's in widespread use. And largely thanks to the rise of the aircraft industry, where, of course, aluminum, because of its lightness, becomes a key material. When Alfonso Bialetti was first investigating the possibilities for creating a kind of stovetop equivalent to those big industrial-strength cafe espresso machines, he adopted aluminum as a kind of state-of-the-art solution. He knew about its conductive properties in terms of heat, and he was fascinated by this idea of a kind of light coffee maker that would, in a sense, deliver coffee from the future, you might almost say, a kind of state-of-the-art but portable and light and domestic equivalent to those industrial espresso machines.
The way it looks, the iconic design that has the different facets on the top half that you you screw onto the bottom half, where did that design come from?
So Alfonso was a metallurgist. He had had some experience with new industrial techniques being used in France, in particular when he came back to his native Piedmont region. He started experimenting with the technical solutions that make up the parts of the Mocha Express stovetop coffee maker. But he wasn't a designer. And so when it came to actually giving it a form, giving it a shape, he basically borrowed, would be the generous way to describe it, what were then some of the most prestigious high-end designs for coffee services that you would have found in a silver store in Paris at the time. So that octagonal shape that becomes the trademark of the Mocha Express is actually inspired by the sorts of high-end silver coffee and tea sets you would have found in a deluxe store in a city like Milan or Turin or certainly Paris.
Okay, so describe for us how the Mocha Express works.
The Mocha Express is a kind of almost alarmingly simple device, but to perfect its physics was not such a simple process. It has a boiler in the bottom that screws into a top section, which contains a sort of central cylinder through which the water, once it's reached a certain temperature, is pushed up through. And in that central axis, there's also a kind of filter element, a little basket that holds the coffee grounds that serve as the medium through which the water is pushed up. And as it's pushed up, eventually it surfaces in the upper container from which it gets poured out into a cup. But the tricky part is not so much the physics of boiling the water below and pushing it up into the upper chamber through the coffee. It's maintaining the proper pressure. And Alfonso Bialetti had to experiment with a number of different designs, and he came up with a pressure valve that basically makes it an extremely safe and reliable device. There are many imitations, and many of them have problems with that pressure device, and they have been known to blow up or fracture or to not work quite so efficiently. What he got right was the balance of those different elements.
It's also just astounding to me how often you see the scene of someone making coffee with a mocha in Italian films of the neorealist period.
Yeah, it's one of those objects like the Vespa scooter that has an absolutely iconic status. It's hard to imagine after the success of the mocha in the 1950s, an Italian household where there isn't a mocha on the stove as a sort of mark of domesticity, of the kind of shared ritual of making coffee, offering coffee to guests, sharing a cup with your spouse. So it really is an object that enters the kind of mainstream of not just Italian culture, really culture throughout the world. The mocha is the sort of vector of a transformation in coffee making and coffee sharing habits that will gradually expand well beyond Europe into South America, North America, even though it's a device that dates back all the way, its creation dates back to the 1930s, its marketing successes date back to the 1950s. they still continue to sell in remarkable numbers. And one of the secrets is it's such a simple device and you can get replacement parts at almost trivial costs, which is to say that the Mocha does not become obsolescent. It goes on and on and on.
When Renato died and these photographs started showing up of his urn, what did you think?
I couldn't but be intrigued by the news story when I saw it in the Italian newspapers. Initially, I noticed that the urn was a very large Bialetti Mocha Express. And as many of your listeners may know, one of the really fascinating features of this product is that it exists on so many different scales, from a single cup version or two cup version all the way up to restaurant size Mocha Expresses. And for his burial site, Renato chose one of those restaurant sized ones. I thought it was a very appropriate, if somewhat humorous, gesture, but it bespeaks of the kind of humor that the Bialetti advertising campaigns were famous for in their heyday in the late 1950s.
Yeah, it's truly wonderful. There's this one image that I think showed up on CNN where you actually see the Mocha filled with the ashes on an altar, a priest blessing it, and his grandchildren standing in front. It's quite marvelous.
It is really marvelous. And I think, I guess what really touched me about those photographs was the presence of the altar, because it hints at the way in which coffee sharing has a kind of secular but sacramental status, you know, in the life of not just Italian families, but, you know, in many, many different kinds of social environments throughout the world. I think the sharing of a cup of coffee is a ritual that we attribute forms of value to that sometimes approach the sacred. So it seemed like a particularly fitting homage to that role that the Mocha has played in creating that kind of culture of sharing, exchange, conversation, and pleasure.
That was Jeffrey Schnapp. He's the director of Metal Lab and teaches Italian and comparative lit at Harvard. Check out some vintage videos of the Omino Coi Baffi on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood.
Adesso, cari telespettatori, faremo un gioco molto divertente. Come si dice oggi? Faremo un quiz. No.
We've been talking about the Mocha Express as an Italian invention, but half the world's top 10 coffee-producing countries are in Latin America. Next, we hear how Latinos who call L.A. home are getting their caffeine fix. That's when Good Food returns.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Immigrants from Latin America drink coffee more than any other ethnic group. To meet the demand in Los Angeles, several specialty coffee hotspots have recently opened their doors. Food and travel writer Valentina Silva wrote a story about the rise of Latino coffee houses in LA for The Guardian. Hi, Valentina. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for having me.
I have to say that I've noticed this as I've been driving around and as I've been, you know, going into shops that haven't been there before. Was there one that sort of started it all?
I think that there are plenty of pioneers in the Latino coffee house category. There was Espresso Mi Cultura in Hollywood. That closed in 2003, though. Zona Rosa in Pasadena, that's been around since the 90s, I think since 96 or 97. What got me to notice it, though, was definitely Tierra Mia. I live in Mount Washington, and so when they moved into Highland Park, it was the first time I'd really understood what a huge draw it was for the community. Highland Park is gentrifying a lot, but when Tierra Mia opened up, they opened it on Avenue 50, and almost everyone there, the whole customer base, was Latino, and I was really surprised because, for one thing, it's not cheap. It's like in the $3 range, and I think there's this idea that Latinos don't want to purchase quality food items. That's kind of been a misnomer in, I think, food culture and then just culture in general. So maybe I also felt that way because I was surprised that so many people were clamoring. And even to this day, it's been open for about a year and still it's packed morning to night all the time.
Do you think that there's something in particular that's driving this upsurge?
I think that there's a base. There's a customer base for it. I think that's probably the biggest thing. Like you said, Latinos, they drink coffee more than any other ethnic group. And I think in LA, they've been served by McDonald's and Starbucks to this point, but there's nothing very Latino about those things. There's nothing catering to them. And I think that finally, there are these coffee houses that are actually catering to them. They have flavors of Latin America that are recognizable. And, you know, there's Spanish music. And if a person speaks Spanish, generally, the baristas speak Spanish at these places. So they're able to communicate. I think it's just a more welcoming environment for some Latinos.
So what are some others? I know that Cafecito Orgánico sort of sprang onto the scene because they started showing up at the Hollywood Farmers Market, and that sort of let a lot of people know that they were there in the community.
Yeah, they've been around since about 2004, I think, and Angelo Rosco is the proprietor of that. It's interesting because he comes to it from a social justice perspective. All his mentors, he told me, they were not coffee people. They were people in political science and people who were really steering him to create a sustainable product or to serve a sustainable product. And he was really interested in what coffee could do for farmers and for communities in Latin America and specifically Central America. He doesn't necessarily put his coffee houses in Latino areas. He actually has them in affluent Anglo neighborhoods. They're in Malibu and Anaheim. There's one in Echo Park. Most of the clientele there is not, you know, a Latino population. So that's really interesting to me. I mean, these Latino coffee houses serve so many different communities in different areas.
Do you find that most of them, because they feel such a deep connection to the community, are really involved with organic and free trade?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that that's one of the biggest things that they have in common is they all have very strong relationships with the farmers whom they source their beans from. Definitely Cafecito Orgánico does organic specifically. I don't know that the rest of them necessarily do organic, but they are very interested in creating a fair trade situation. And they're also interested in, you know, really creating intimate relationships with the farmers that they work with. I know that at Primera Taza, Chuy Tuivar, he's the co-owner of it. He's in Mexico all the time trying to source the perfect beans and really create good relationships with these farmers.
So do you think that all of these Latino-run coffee houses are bringing in beans more from the Latin American world of coffee growing rather than, let's say, the African world of coffee growing?
Yeah, I definitely noticed that. I know that Tierra Mía, they definitely use Ethiopian beans and Cafecito Orgánico as well, but the emphasis is definitely on South and Central America, a little bit of Mexico. Ulysses Romero, he was saying to me that it's really important when he started it that he didn't see anyone kind of making the connection between Latin America and coffee, despite the fact, like, as you said, that most of the coffee consumed in America is Latin American, but nobody was making that connection very literally or very specifically within the coffee house. So he really wanted to put that at the forefront.
Do these coffee houses have particular drinks that also put sort of a more Latino vibe into the cup?
Definitely Tierra Mía does. They do a horchata latte and a coco loco, and they do that. But to me, Primera Taza, Chuy Tuivar, he's very interesting because he's doing kind of more niche items. For one, he does a café de olla. It's a small batch. It's delicious. It's beautiful.
Can you describe what it is?
Yeah, sure. It's coffee that's cooked in a pot, and he cooks it with cinnamon and piloncillo. It's an unrefined sugar that comes in like a cone shape. So he cooks that down and he makes very small batches because he says the large batches take forever. So if you can get there in time, it's worth it because you can get it cold or hot and it's not too sweet. It's really delicious. And it puts coffee at the forefront also. A lot of café de ollas around town, you can get them, you know, in a lot of different Latino neighborhoods, but they tend to make coffee kind of the afterthought. And his is, that's, it's first and foremost for him.
Yeah, and I've noticed that the dirty horchata has become a thing.
Yeah.
Which is great, adding a shot of cold brew to a nice iced cup of horchata.
Yeah, if you can handle it, it's a really good thing.
Are there any other players that we've left out?
I think Antigua Coffee House is a really interesting example.
Which is run by Yancy Quiñones.
Yeah, when it first started, it was in El Sereno. And then he moved it to Cypress Park, which is the neighborhood he grew up in. And as that neighborhood has changed demographically, it's become gentrified, so too has his clientele. It's very interesting. His client's base has changed a lot, yet he feels like he hasn't had to change anything. He feels like the neighborhood, the new clients, new customers, they really appreciate the, you know, his Guatemalan vibe. And, you know, on his packaging, he has a Mayan god on it. And, you know, the music is Latin music. And he says that he feels like people really appreciate it. And he doesn't feel like he has to change anything.
Which is kind of great because not everything needs to look like Starbucks.
Yeah, exactly.
And in most of these places, I think the sort of joy and the fun of being in them is that they do feel like they're neighborhood expressions or expressions of the owner.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And a lot of them, too, I noticed that there's not like a computer, a laptop situation there, you know, in laptop culture. It seems like there's a lot of talking and a lot of families, which also, I mean, having your kid in a coffee place is sometimes a taboo. But in a lot of these places, it's just a given. You're expected to have your kid in there. And they have plenty of amenities for children in terms of, you know, drinks and things. So
does music also add another layer?
Yeah, there's plenty of music there. You know, you can get cumbia beats or Spanish rock when you walk in. So it definitely adds to the vibe. And it definitely makes you not want to work on your laptop. You want to kind of have a discussion or have some fun while you're in there.
And what about food?
Yeah, I think Tia Mia, they have tres leches muffins and guava pastries and things like that. But once again, I have to come back to Primera Taza because they're doing a lonche, this like wonderful sandwich that they can only do about once a month when they can ship in the bread.
So it's so crazy that he does that.
Yeah. He's so meticulous about his sourcing. So I get it.
Where does the bread come from?
The bread, I believe, is from Guadalajara. So, and then everything else, I think he's having a special person make his cheese and, you know, and then Corazon y Miel is making the pork for his pork lonche. So that's amazing. I mean, where are you going to, are you going to get that on a daily basis?
Yeah, Ricardo Diaz.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty special sandwich.
Yeah, definitely. I actually haven't been able to try it yet because I can't get to it because it's so rare these days.
Yeah, you should pre-order it. I'm sure they keep one for
you.
Yeah,
I'm sure you would too.
Well, Valentina, what a pleasure to have you come in. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
That was food and travel writer Valentina Silva. Find a link to her story on the rise of Latino coffee houses in LA on our website. If guava pastries and lonches de lomo aren't your thing, I bet you can find something to make yourself at your local farmer's market. Let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. So happy today to be visiting with Brandon Kida, who is the executive chef at Hinoki and the Bird in Century City. So tell us about a special ingredient you're getting today.
The season is starting for nettles, and it's one of my favorite ingredients. As a child, I used to go to camp, and we used to take these stinging nettles and smack them on each other, But now I cook with them, and they're such an amazing ingredient. They have a roundness to them. They have a nuttiness to them. Really deep flavor. So I enjoy using them.
Okay, and when you say stinging, it literally, you can't touch the leaves with your bare hands.
The leaves are kind of fine. As the plant grows and matures, it gets these little thorns on them, and it does create quite an irritation, yeah.
Okay, so what's the method then for, first of all, picking them up when you get from the market to home?
So, obviously, look for a healthy-looking plant, and then get home, and you put on those thick gloves. We have a set of stinging nettle gloves at the restaurants. They're super thick rubber gloves. And you're basically just pulling off the leaves and then discarding the stems.
But once they're blanched, then all that stingingness goes away.
Correct, yeah. From then on, they're just like using another green, like spinach or something like that.
Yeah, it's a small leaf, and I'm assumed the minute it's blanched, it just gets completely limp.
Correct, but it still has a nice, firm, like kale, you know, bite to it.
So then what is it mainly used for? Fillings for things?
You can use it for fillings. I like to saute it and create purees and things of that nature because it has such a strong flavor that you can kind of, it can stand on its own. It has a very strong flavor. With cheeses and pastas, it does well.
So the dish that you're going to be making with these nettles, what will that be?
So the one I created for this dish is a take on a traditional Japanese soba dish. So we made soba noodles, so buckwheat, based on buckwheat. And we created a kimchi, nettle kimchi. So we took nettles and we did the traditional method of making kimchi. Instead of cabbage, we replaced it with nettles and we let it ferment. And that was the topping for the noodles. And then we made a nettle puree on the bottom. So you have this creaminess and you have the acidity and you have the roundness. So
sounds great. And that'll be a seasonal dish as long as the nettles are around?
Correct. It's one of those market plates that we'll do.
That sounds absolutely amazing. How long do we expect the nettles to last?
I've used them all throughout the summer, but as the summer goes on, as it gets hotter, they do mature and they do get a little bit harder to deal with.
And do you forage at all for this?
Personally, I don't. I unfortunately don't have the time to go off into the mountains and you know, forage for nettles, but I forage at the market.
Okay, well, good, really good tips, not only how to handle nettles, but then how to cook with them. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Brendan Kida. He is the executive chef at Hinoki and the Bird in Century City, cooking seasonally from the farmer's market and telling us how to handle those nettles. So we're going to talk to Dawn Birch right now at Florabella Farm about how do the wild nettles grow and how often can you get them?
Well, the wild nettles come in the wintertime when it gets wet. They grow on the sides of our fields where we're doing a lot of watering, and we simply harvest them.
Okay, so they're very dependent on Mother Nature.
Very dependent on Mother Nature. We only harvest what grows on our farm because that's deemed organic. But you can go up in the hills and anywhere where there's a lot of dampness along streams or waterways, you will find wild stinging nettles growing.
Do you go out and get them at a certain stage of their size?
No, people are clamoring for them, whether they're large or small. People prefer the large leaf, but they'll take the really small leaf as well.
And do they thrive from being harvested a lot? Will they produce more and more, or once they're picked, they're gone?
No, once they're picked, they're gone, and it depends how the season goes. If we keep getting rainy, wet days, we'll get more nettles.
If you get stung, how long does the stinging sensation last?
The sting can last anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour, and it depends on your personal metabolism. I've actually stung people who have asked to be stung. Simultaneously, two people held their hands out, and I'm stinging both of them, and one is saying, I can't feel it, and the other one is getting red welts. Mm-hmm. But you know, the sting is very medicinal. And if you're suffering from arthritis, you should take the bunch of stinging nettles and you should whack your arthritic part. And it's going to feel like multitude of bee stings. And the blood is going to rush to that location and it's going to blow out your joints, much like turning a faucet on real hard to unclog the drain. What's actually stinging you, there's an oil. And it deposits little oil droplets on your skin. And it's a toxin, but it's a good toxin. And that's what makes stinging nettles so unique and delicious and healthy. They're on the super green list. They're one of the healthiest greens on the planet. And we would do well to stop calling them a weed and start calling them a side dish.
Dawn, when you harvest the nettles, do you wear gloves?
I actually don't. I've used the nettles medicinally on my knuckles for years and years, and I've become really accustomed to them. And I'll tell you, I cannot walk through the nettles in shorts because I am not accustomed to stings on my legs.
Mm-hmm. And how about the other workers who pick them?
I don't think they wear gloves when they pick them. These guys are a pretty hardy crew, and they're picking with their hands 40 hours a week, and I don't think little nettles are going to bother them.
Are there ways to harvest the seeds and just start planting them?
Yes. You can take a bunch of stinging nettles and simply shake it, mm-hmm. and in time you will have more stinging nettles People ask me, they say my yard is full of these. What should I do? And I suggest that they eat them.
Eat them. All right, Dawn. Well, thank you so much. I'm glad you're bringing these, popularizing them. Chefs are using them, and they certainly sound like a fascinating thing to try.
Thank you very much.
That was Dawn Birch, and she is a farmer at Florabella Farm up at Three Rivers. She and her husband, James Birch, grow all kinds of stuff and then are happy to be harvesting wild nettles as well. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You heard it here first. Wild stinging nettles are back in season now at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And we've got a recipe for Chef Brandon Kida's buckwheat soba noodles with nettles kimchi. It's on the Good Food blog. In a minute, we hear from that fiery Frenchman who ran Le Bec Vin. Stay close.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
Ice cream because I'm asking them the best because I'm giving my best every night. I'm teaching them something nobody can teach them. I know that's a fact. And what I teach them is love. It's to be proud of what you do, to love and the perfection that the very few people have in this world.
That's a clip from the new documentary, King George, which takes a look at the last years of Le Bec Vin in Philadelphia and its passionate chef, George Perrier. First-time filmmaker Erica Frankel directed the film, which has its national release this week in L.A., New York, and Philadelphia. Hi, Erica.
Hi.
For people who don't know Le Bec Vin, could you tell us a bit about the restaurant and the place it held in Philadelphia?
Sure. You can't talk about Le Bec Vin without talking about its chef and creator, Georges Perrier, because they were kind of one and the same entity. Georges came over from France in the late 60s. He was in his 20s and was kind of an instant superstar in Philadelphia at a restaurant called La Panettiere. And then he started Le Bec Vin, which really was one of the first restaurants to introduce Americans to fine French cuisine. And he stayed there for 43 years, which is remarkable in the food business.
Quite remarkable.
Yeah. And it really became a beacon also for Philadelphia. It changed downtown Philadelphia, a street called Walnut Street, where it was for about 30 years, into like the Fifth Avenue of Philadelphia and, you know, drew a lot of celebrities from New York, diplomats from Washington, kings and queens from all over the world. It really became, a centerpiece in the city.
What about the restaurant and George in particular made you want to focus on him?
Well, I'm from outside of Philadelphia, and growing up in that area, he was such a big character that you couldn't grow up without hearing about him. And so in 2010, when I heard that he was thinking of closing the restaurant, I immediately thought that was a historic thing for not only the food world, but also for the Philadelphia area, just because, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people have passed through his kitchen and now have their own restaurants or work in some facet of the industry. And once I got in touch with him and started filming and saw how passionate he was and what a character he was on camera, I just kept filming for about 3 years.
Now, we've been using the words passionate and a character.
Mm-hmm.
But in the kitchen, George is this old school chef where he's demanding, borderline abusive. There's a lot of language. When you first were in the kitchen, were you shocked?
Yeah, it's scary. It's scary, and you almost want to laugh. It's shocking. There are a lot of emotions because you don't see a lot of people act that way a lot of the time. But I think there's a scene in the film where someone ordered galettes, and the galettes are burnt, and George has to run downstairs and remake the galettes.
We heard a clip of that scene at the beginning of this segment.
Yeah, he talks about, you know, how passionate he is about what he does and the importance of perfection. And I think once you understand that about him, the yelling and that behavior makes sense. Because there's a method to the madness.
Also, when you see how fast he's able to whip up a batch because of his really deep-seated technical knowledge of the cuisine, you understand his frustration on another level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cursing in the kitchen. There's a lot of F you, but I think what he's often saying to people is, I love you. It's just with a different word. But I think a lot of what happens in that kitchen is actually about love and connecting with people, even if it comes out in four-letter profane words that we can't use here.
You know, some time has passed since the restaurant closed, but there were so many sweet moments in the film, like the scene where one of the line cooks gives George a birthday card she made for him. Mm-hmm. It's obvious that the bonds he had with a lot of the young people who worked with him superseded his toughness with them. Do those bonds continue in his life today?
Absolutely. We actually, today we're at the North End Grill, Danny Meyer's restaurant in New York City, and George is cooking here tonight, and actually with him is Michael Franco. He was a manager at the restaurant and went on to work for Thomas Keller, but he, you know, George continues cooking with the people that came through his kitchen all those, you know, all those 40 years that he was there. He still does a lot of guest chef events all over Philadelphia and in a lot of the restaurants that people that worked for him at one point are bringing him back in to continue the tradition.
In this moment where chefs are portrayed as being quite young, very tattooed, in the full flush of their physical endurance, it's difficult to see what a lifelong chef looks like at the end of that career. It leads to some really sad moments in the film when he's, you know, home puttering around and you see him with his little doggy. Did you feel it was really important to show that arc?
Yeah, absolutely. At first when I was making the film, I started by thinking, well, this is a film about the restaurant ending. But as we kept filming, you know, it really became a biography and a portrait of this person. And so to me, it was really important to have kind of as many different elements of his life to put in there just so that you could get a fuller picture. To me, it was important to kind of have all parts of the spectrum covered. And a lot of the things that people have to give up to be a chef of his caliber.
Erica, I understand that you have George with you. Could you put him on the phone?
Hold on.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm fine.
So, George, what are you working on now? How do you spend your days?
I enjoy my day. I can finally date some woman. I play a lot of golf. I love it. It's wonderful.
So there actually is life for you after Le Bec Fin.
Life is great. I love life after Le Bec Fin. You know, I give everything Le Bec Fin for so many years and to the people in Philadelphia, and now I just enjoy life.
Because when we watch the film, we can really see your devastation at the realization that you're going to have to close.
Well, I was devastated at the time because, you know, I mean, when you own a restaurant for 42 years and you're on top of the world and you're a big star and suddenly you got to give it all. And say, people's going to forget me. And that's when I start crying at night. Say, oh, they're going to forget me. I'll be nobody. You know, it's tough. But it's not that it didn't happen that way. People still remember me. I walk down the street. They stop me. Thank you for what you have done to Philadelphia. Without you, there will be no cooking. I'm a very lucky guy. It's wonderful.
And so many of the young people that you helped build careers.
Yeah, and so many of the young people to open restaurants and... And I did a lot, you know, I mean, I got two my best guy on the two best restaurants, maybe on the country, are in Philadelphia. Kevin Spraga, top chef, and he can be top chef. I mean, I got two guys who work with me, two top chefs. Very special.
Well, I'll let you go, George. I know you're really busy today. You're cooking a dinner.
Oh, you're so sweet. I love your voice. Maybe one day we'll get to meet.
That was Chef George Perrier. He's the star of King George, a movie directed by Erica Frankel that's being screened at the Arena Cinema in Hollywood now and at theaters in New York and Philadelphia. Find a trailer on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood.
Now, let's move from French cuisine to a new American bistro in Studio City called The Bellwether. Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Take it away, Jonathan.
The chef is Ted Hobson, who used to work with Seng Yun at Father's Office and at Luxon, I think.
Really good chef.
Yes.
And what kind of food is he making at Bellwether?
If you were to diagram what would be on the menu of the modern American bistro, I would think that 9/10 of the dishes you would think of would be on this menu. And sometimes when you're thinking about it, it's a little bit funny. They happen to be pretty good.
And it's what people want to eat.
It's what people want to eat. So you might be asking yourself, are there craft cocktails?
Of course.
Of course there are craft cocktails, including, you know, barrel-aged Manhattans that they pour for $9 during happy hour. You know, is there a list of craft beers on tap? Of course there's a list of craft beers on tap. Many of them as bitter as tears. There's charred crisp Brussels sprouts, which are delicious, and they come in a spicy maple vinegar sauce with little bacon chunks. There are roasted carrots. There have to be roasted carrots. This comes with a carrot juice that's flavored with chamomile and roasted hazelnuts. It's garnished with its own tops. And they're super sweet and super buttery. And
you got the crunch of the nuts.
You got the crunch of the nuts. It's a good modern dish. Are there roasted beets? Of course there are roasted beets.
So this is like the greatest hits template.
Yeah. And it's the way everybody wants to eat now, right? You get a bunch of amusing vegetable dishes, and then you maybe get a big dish at the end to share for the table. So the French fries are fantastic. Apparently there's this whole process of soaking in vinegar water and steaming and freezing and then frying, but all you have to know is that they're super crisp on the outside and almost, you know, vanishingly fluffy on the inside, and that they're coated with spicy salt. There are meatballs. There are always meatballs.
Well, that's a new always.
That is a new always.
But it's good. It's good. Yeah. It's been added to the canon.
That are big and tender, and there's a good tomato sauce that's been cooked down. There's a little bit of ricotta and, you know, the fatunta on the side.
Oh, good.
Grilled bread. Everybody likes grilled bread.
So the large format plates, are they pretty straight ahead American, or are they inflected with provenance that comes from elsewhere?
Some of each. On Mondays are the best nights to go because it's fried chicken night. And you have a choice between regular fried chicken, which is crunchy and nice, or the Nashville hot chicken, which is becoming a fad now, but it's a fad that I'm happy to see around. Super spicy, dyed almost red with the hot sauce in which they've been cooked and the cayenne.
So are people already asking for half and half?
Oh, I'd never even thought of that.
Really?
I always go with a group and get one of each. So I guess that's the same.
Yeah.
There's a patty melt.
Ooh, really?
It's not something you'd expect, but it's a really good
Patty melts, and there are so few really good ones.
It's on a really good rye bread. They use taleggio with caramelized onions, which, you know, melts into almost nothing. There's probably a touch of aioli in there.
I love that you got me excited from a patty melt.
Because this is a restaurant where you want to go to spend a Tuesday night, right? And one of the stars of the big plate menu is just a big plate of stewed chickpeas with tomato sauce, a couple of dates, and some za'atar.
That sounds good.
It is good.
You know, there was a lot of vegetable matter in this menu that we talked about.
It's the modern template of the meal, I think, is a lot of shared vegetable plates, which you end with a big plate that may or may not have meat in it. And for dessert, there's a couple of things, but what you're probably going to want is the bread pudding. Is it complicated? Does it have strange things in it? No, it's basically bread pudding, but it's good.
Sounds like a great place. The Bellwether.
The Bellwether.
In the Valley. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about the bellwether in Studio City. Text the words good food to 69866 and you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Up next, we take a trip to farm country. Steak.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food. Earlier this month, the New York Times published an op-ed that took a stand against legislation that makes it illegal to videotape or record footage on farms and in slaughterhouses. Critics of these regulations call them ag gag laws. Peggy Lowe, investigations editor for Harvest Public Media, is here to break down both sides of the debate. Hi, Peggy.
Hey, Evan.
I suppose I want to start out by just asking, why would anyone be videotaping on farms or in slaughterhouses?
Well, there's lots of people out there, you know, animal rights activists among others, who feel that many of the animals that are being mass-produced for meat in large confinement areas are mistreated. So they'll go undercover and they will have videotape, among other things, and become whistleblowers. And they want to expose what they consider the poor treatment of these animals in these large production facilities.
Ergo, the agricultural gag laws, or ag gag.
Exactly. Now, that was coined by Mark Bittman in 2011, but what it basically means is there's laws on the books in about a dozen states that will criminalize this whistleblowing activity. The agriculture industry is calling these folks terrorists, and they're saying it's unfair for them to come in, pretend to be an employee, tape what they consider something that doesn't happen every day, and then make pariahs out of these peoples or owners on the internet. So that's why they have moved to criminalize this.
It's pretty unusual for the New York Times to come out and write an editorial of this kind. And they did that in response to what just happened in North Carolina, which now has an ag gag law that is probably the most stringent in the U.S.
That's right. The North Carolina ag gag law goes way beyond any of the other states' laws because it criminalizes the behavior of employees in nursing homes and daycare centers, you know, places far away from the farm. So it doesn't just include agriculture. Now, that is being challenged in federal court. But to your point about the Times' opinion piece, I thought it was really strong and I liked it because it basically said, just on the face of it, this law is so anti-First Amendment. This violates the Constitution, and it shouldn't stand. So, yeah, that was a really interesting development, I thought, in this, you know, length of time we've had these ag gag laws.
What I find so interesting, too, about the North Carolina law is that in grouping farm animals and some of our most vulnerable people, you know, elderly patients or children in daycare centers, I find that a really interesting leap.
Interesting leap is a nice and diplomatic way to say that, I think, because people in farm country would suggest that animal rights activists have gone way too far and that they are equating animals with people. And that's part of their problem with ag gag laws. You know, some people, these ag gag laws have been passed in a number of farm country states. It's because people in the ag industry, many of them anyway, that do this mass production, really feel under fire. So that's why they came out with these very strong laws.
It's also interesting because we seem to be in a time that current technology allows for more and more transparency with a much lower economic
burden. So you have these two streams where you have people pushing for more transparency, like, for example, noted animal scientist Temple Grandin, who actually has urged that video cameras be placed in slaughterhouses to live stream production lines. And then you have this unbelievable pushback from industry who really doesn't want the public to see.
You're absolutely right. I mean, now the technology is there and it's cheap. So anyone with an iPhone can go undercover and get these kinds of videos. So that's certainly interesting. And Temple Grandin, yes, she has said that she wants more transparency. And she, you know, she is often a defender of the livestock industry, but she's also a reformer. So that's kind of interesting. And also about transparency, consumers say more and more often that they want to know what goes into their food. That is what we cover every day at Harvest Public Media. And so that's why they want to know, how are these animals produced? How are chickens raised? How are pigs raised? How are cattle raised? And so they want to know if it is negative towards the animal. They're concerned about animal welfare.
Have some ag-gag laws been struck down by certain jurisdictions?
Well, that's an interesting question. In fact, Tennessee just failed to enact an ag-gag law that was based upon the North Carolina law. Idaho just had their ag-gag law struck down last year, and we've really been watching that. And that certainly heartened not only animal rights activists, but it heartened people who advocate for the First Amendment and for free speech and for whistleblowers. So the Idaho law has been really watched the most in the last year or so.
There's no ag-gag law in the books in California. I understand that in 2008, an initiative was passed that banned the worst kinds of intensive confinement of farm animals. Why should the average eater care about these kinds of laws?
The average eater should care because they want to know how their food was raised. You know, there are terrible conditions in some of these confinement places. There just are. Which is justified by saying that, you know, to do mass production, we must produce at this scale. So the average eater might want to know where their food comes from. I mean, look at Chipotle. You know, the whole food with integrity idea is really appealing to a lot of people. They do care where it comes from. I would also suggest, though, in California, what's interesting about that is your state does have a significant beef industry, but mostly it has, you know, vegetables and fruit. So perhaps the ag-gag laws aren't as important in California as they are in, say, farm country.
So what is the impact on these kind of laws on investigative reporters like you?
They are a field day for us. I mean, it's really fun to look into this kind of thing because, first of all, we like to follow the money to find out who wants these kinds of laws. In Missouri, for example, when it was passed here, I took a look at all the contributions. Those were from political contributions from the Farm Bureau, which are sort of the Republicans of farm country. They were from big livestock producers like JBS and Tyson, all those big meat companies. So that's interesting in and of itself. But it also gives us the opportunity, I think, to do some explanatory journalism. This is how your food is raised. You know, this is what a hog confinement looks like. This is why you need to know and care about where your food comes from.
You know, and then to me, whenever we have these conversations, it harkens back to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, the famous early 20th century expose of the meat industry. And I sort of feel like, you know, everything that's old is new again, but in a really bad way.
I agree. And I go back to the idea of the jungle a lot in my reporting. Upton Sinclair first wrote that to expose the dangers that workers had on the jobs at these meat processing facilities in Chicago. In fact, what happened then is the public grabbed onto the idea that the food was unsafe, that there were lots of poisons and rats and things like that in the meat. So from what I understand and from what I've read, Sinclair was a bit upset that people didn't, you know, look more at the people producing this meat, but rather the food safety angle. But certainly, I think more and more food journalism is really evolving and looking more deeply at these issues. And so it's a really fascinating time to be writing and investigating food production.
Thank you so much, Peggy.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, Evan.
Peggy Lowe is investigations editor for Harvest Public Media, a group of public media stations in the Midwest that cover agriculture and food production. Learn more about ag-gag regulations on our website. To close out this week's show, we're going to play some music that inspires famed Indian actress and cookbook author Madhur Jaffrey in the kitchen, starting with Lena Horne. Jaffrey talked to KCRW's Aaron Bird about stormy weather for the Guest DJ project.
And I had seen her in films, and she was so beautiful. And I thought of her life, because I knew a little bit about her life, even in India. I thought, she's gone through so much and such a difficult life, and yet she's managed to find work. She pushes herself, gets the work, gets in where she needs to be, and is a beautiful singer and a beautiful human being. So then again, she became for me a kind of idol, that this is, I could do that. There are women like that who are like me. I was young, I was too young at that time, but I could look up to these women who would take my hand and lead me along, metaphorically at least. And from her, I have selected Stormy Weather, which is a song I love.
Can't go on, everything I had is gone. Stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together, keeps raining all the time, keeps raining all the time.
That was Lena Horne with the classic Stormy Weather. I'm here with award-winning chef and actress Madhur Jaffrey, talking about songs that have inspired her throughout her life. So for your third choice, what do we have?
So we have a man now. We have Frank Sinatra. Now, who doesn't love Frank Sinatra? And we certainly heard his songs in India. And then I was in England, studying in England. We heard his songs then. And he just, there was a kind of romantic quality to his singing that I found both sexy and attractive. And there were some men, because I was just, in a way, growing up, discovering my own body, discovering my own sexuality, and he somehow fit in a very nice, soft, romantic way. So again, I turned to him to get all my juices, as it were, going. And that was the attraction, I think, of this particular song, which is The Way You Look Tonight.
And the way you look tonight.
Is cooking a sensual experience for you?
Absolutely. Cooking is not. Eating. Eating is completely sensual. There's no aspect of eating that isn't. Smelling, tasting, the fingers, the use of the fingers. I remember once I was in Korea, and you know, in Korea they eat with knitting needle type metal chopsticks. And this woman who'd invited me, very nice woman, very knowledgeable about food, and she says, you know, I went to India and they all eat with their hands and I don't like that very much. And I said, well, we don't make love with knitting needles either. Because both these things are sensual, and you need the body to be sensual, to touch, to taste.
That was cookbook author Madhur Jaffrey sharing songs that inspire her for KCRW's Guest DJ project. We have a link to her whole conversation with Aaron on our website. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's mobile app. Many thanks to the Good Food team. That is Abby Fentress Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Tsay, Joseph Stone, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.